One night in 1992 in the Washington, D.C. suburb of McLean, Virginia, neighbors might have noticed two men walking down the street. One short, squat, the other tall, talking to each other as they strolled past lawns and driveways, chatting it up like old friends. It may not have been obvious to those neighbors that one was about to betray the other. That might be a little strong characterization of what happened between Antonin Scalia and Anthony Kennedy. We do know that Justice Scalia thought he had Kennedy's vote on a very important case as a result of their now infamous walk through the town where they lived just blocks from each other, and that Justice Kennedy would see things very differently from Scalia, and the bitterness would be obvious in the opinion and the dissent recorded in the records of the highest court in the land. We will discuss this case, these two justices, and look as close as we can at the somewhat enigmatic man who is now the most studied justice on the court, and the case that made him so, in the wake of a decision coming up about the nation's healthcare system, arguably the most watched court case since 2000. But first, a man who might have sat on the highest court in the land if he just answered a telegram. John J. Parker, the Honorable John J. Parker, Justice of the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, Virginia, and in 1930, President Hoover's nominee to the Supreme Court. He's looking pretty good for a nomination. A North Carolinian, he's got support from those friendly regional Southern senators. And George Norris, a progressive Nebraska senator, sometimes at odds with those senators, he says there's nothing but good feeling for Parker in the Senate. Eventually, though, two problems came up. Parker wrote a decision enforcing so-called yellow dog contracts, where workers would get a job by signing away their rights to join a union. In United Mine Workers vs. Red Jacket Coal, Parker argued that the contracts cannot be broken, and the United Mine Workers needed to stay away from the West Virginia mine workers in those mines where people had signed those contracts. For the time, though, 1930 isn't shocking at all. In fact, even the United Mine Workers didn't really have the appetite to oppose him. But another problem developed with Judge Parker. As a candidate for governor of North Carolina in 1908, he made a speech. A speech in which he said the participation of black voters was an evil. He also goes on to say at the stump that black voters had not reached the level of development. The Republican Party does not want them. The then 20-year-old NAACP and its leader, Walter White, are concerned, but they're willing to hear Judge Parker out. So White sends a telegram to Judge Parker asking him to explain and asking him if what the speech said still reflects his current thinking. The telegram is an olive branch. Day one goes by. Day two. Day three. And no answer. White checks with Western Union. Yes, the judge got the telegram, and yes, he signed for it. Okay, then, the NAACP takes his no answer as a no, as acceptance that Parker has not changed his position, and a campaign is organized against him. George Norris, the senator from Nebraska, now comes out against Parker. So does William Borah. So does Burton Wheeler and Hiram Johnson, the senator from California, and then senator of Alabama, progressive, soon to be on the court later, Hugo Black. These are the progressives in 1930. Parker's comments are an unsufferable affront to millions of American voters, Senator Robert Wagner of New York says. Then the senators go to President Hoover and say, look, you've got to withdraw Parker's nomination. He does not. Despite the support of the president of a black college in North Carolina, despite the fact that Parker struck down a housing law permitting racial segregation in Richmond, despite the fact he struck that out, despite the fact that his defense was he was making a campaign speech where he was being attacked by people that were way more segregationist than he. Despite that, he loses his nomination by one vote in the Senate. And the result of that is Owen J. Roberts, a Republican from Pennsylvania, district attorney there and Interior Department prosecutor who had worked on getting the bad guys of his own party prosecuted in the Teapot Dome scandal, was quickly confirmed. As Hoover left and Franklin Roosevelt came into office, Roberts on the court became a carefully watched swing vote as New Deal legislation after New Deal legislation was enacted. Mostly, he sided with the court's liberals, but in some cases, in particularly high-publicity ones, he sided with the so-called Four Horsemen, the four conservative justices who were opposing FDR's New Deal. Congress and the president were shocked when Roberts wrote a 1935 opinion knocking down the Agricultural Adjustment Act, prize of the New Deal. He knocked down a bill requiring railroads to fund employee pensions, a precursor to Social Security. And FDR's proud Blue Eagle, he ruled unconstitutional, though in that case, so did every other member of the court. A few more of these type decisions, and more than a few people began to notice that 1936, the re-election of Franklin Roosevelt was coming around. What about Owen J. Roberts, Time magazine reported. A group of Philadelphia GOP bosses is saying. Hoover liked him, Coolidge had liked him, he had some bipartisan cred, he did prosecute the Republicans in Teapot Dome. Well, wait, you can't run a Supreme Court justice for president, can you? Well, you can technically, there's nothing not allowing that in the Constitution, and in these days of TV, I don't know if it's a good pick, any of our Supreme Court justices, but you never know. In 1936, you have to remember, you're only 20 years away from the candidacy of Charles Evan Hughes, who ran in 1916 and came darn near close to becoming president. So no, nothing stopping the guy in the robe from becoming the man in the White House. But you had to play it right. Owen, of course, said nothing, maintained what Time magazine said was a dignified silence. Then in 1936, he struck down a minimum wage law in New York, siding with the conservatives again, and received some positive press from national conservatives. But here, even some Republicans were upset. This wasn't striking a blow at some federal program, at FDR. This was a state bill that had Republican support among New York legislatures. Minimum wage law. Was he becoming now one of the Four Horsemen in an effort to run for president? He never got the nod of his party, Mr. Roberts, in any case. He claimed he never sought it. And he said that he would keep the court and White House separate if he had anything to do with it. And judges shouldn't even be put in the spotlight of the presidency. It was almost protesting too much. With a second term, FDR took on the court and proposed a court-packing plan where he would add new justices that FDR would get to appoint. As the Senate was considering the plan, and reluctantly, the Supreme Court was hearing another minimum wage case, this time in the state of Washington. And this time, the circumstances were identical. Roberts ruled it constitutional now. He switched. It was, the paper said, the switch in time that saved nine. The vote on the court on a case that would convince the Senate to not go with FDR's packing plan. Many thought that it was the impetus behind Roberts and Chief Justice Hughes switching on that case. But Hughes, the Chief Justice, insisted that the vote in conference had been many months before the president proposed his court-packing plan, and Roberts did not switch his vote. Roberts would write a memo to the same effect, although in his memo he would say he ruled it unconstitutional the one time, and a year later constitutional, because in the previous case, the plaintiff hadn't argued it well enough. There were more than a few raised eyebrows. After that, Roberts would switch his vote again, upholding a second agricultural adjustment bill, and favoring the price regulation of tobacco. Then FDR would get a few more appointments on the court, nothing like getting your way to ease the tension between the president and the judicial branch. Roberts had been placed there as a swing justice by the defeat of Judge Parker. A similar situation occurred in 1987, when President Reagan nominated Robert Bork to the Supreme Court. And Reagan said, well, we all know that Judge Bork has come under attack for being some kind of right-wing ideologue. We know that those charges are wrong. It was a good introduction, but Bork was a talker, a professor who taught at Yale, and his students, including a young Bill Clinton, were fond of his classes because he was such a good arguer. But they almost called him pro-trust. He called anti-trust legislation errors. He was extreme conservative. In 1963, he wrote a New Republic article opposing civil rights laws, including those prohibiting restaurants from refusing to serve blacks. And he left no doubt on abortion, like a lot of justices do today. Bork said, Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. Well, this led to a lot of pressures on senators after a hearing where Bork was under attack for refusing to see a privacy right at all in law. He lost Democratic support, certainly. Pro-choice groups were angered. But Republican Specter of Pennsylvania, Packwood of Oregon, after a well-publicized campaign against him, he lost support, and he lost in the floor vote in the largest margin in history of any judge, 58-42. So Reagan had another plan. His AG, Edwin Meese, knew this guy Douglas Ginsburg. He had only 13 decisions in the Court of Appeals to pick on, so he could coast through. But, and back in 87, this would sink you instead of giving you a round of high fives as it might this day or generating a yawn. He admitted to smoking marijuana in the 60s and the 70s. That couldn't do, so Reagan went with a person suggested by his moderate chief of staff, Howard Baker. Anthony Kennedy, who Reagan knew. He was a moderate who, under Gerald Ford, had been put on the circuit court, served for 12 years there, ran his father's law firm in Sacramento. He's a well-known Republican involved in politics. The family had some ties to Governor Reagan in California. Democrats in the Senate liked him, and everybody was tired of the nomination process at this point. Some of the Republicans saw it as too much of a compromise. Pat Buchanan said, now in the White House, it's let's go out there and compromise for the Gipper. He stopped going for the home run and went for the single, Times said. Kennedy was easily confirmed. And now, as a result of those actions in 1987 and 1988, he is the second longest serving justice. Scalia is the first longest serving justice. He's not the oldest man on the court. Scalia beats him by a couple of months and Ginsburg by a couple of years. And since the retirement of Sandra Day O'Connor, Kennedy finds himself, not unlike Owen Roberts, the swing vote, the one that the press is looking at, the one that briefs and oral arguments and lawyers sometimes direct to. Judicial power is often difficult to exercise. We cannot here ask another branch to share responsibility as to when the argument is made, a statute is flawed or incomplete. The outcome can be laid at no other door but ours. Anthony Kennedy in Johnson v. Texas, in which Kennedy sided with the majority and threw out the conviction of a man who burned the flag at the 1984 Republican convention. Johnson v. Texas, better known as the flag-burning case, a kind of don't-kill-the-messenger speech Kennedy made there, one that reflects the anger at the court that he was receiving from veterans and flag lovers. Yet, no timidus is directed when one listens to the oral argument for Johnson v. Texas. And there's not much surprise that Kennedy would side with the majority. The opinion of William Brennan in that case would have been easy to predict for anyone who listened or just got a transcript of the oral arguments. Those oral arguments are not televised. In it, he goes after the attorney for the state of Texas, who is arguing that the flag needs protection as a symbol. So is the cross, he says. You can't protect a symbol by other methods than criminal law? Then he asks a question to the lawyer for Texas. Your statute applies to state flags too, doesn't it? Yes, the Texas lawyer answers. State and national is in the statute. So the amount of flags with constitutional protection is now 51, Kennedy asks. The question is a shot at Texas's case. Start giving constitutional protection to one flag, and you'll get a whole lot of symbols to protect with the Constitution. Too much for Kennedy. Well, I don't think one should be allowed to put a swastika on the Alamo, the Texas lawyer says. Kennedy's not buying it. That's private property. That's a different argument. In oral argument for that case, that's all we get from Kennedy. That's it. He does not ask Johnson's attorney, the flag burner's attorney, any questions, and then he rules against Texas. From that case, we might think he's a fairly straightforward, easy-to-read judge. Then what is all this talk about the enigmatic man, the Sphinx of Sacramento, who can't be divined? What is everyone worrying about? Well, a lot of that comes from a case called Casey v. Planned Parenthood. So, let's take a look at that. In 1992, with protesters on both sides wanting to hear the verdict, with rumors that the court's decision in the Roe v. Wade abortion case will be overturned, and then, surprise, the court, in a close 5-4 decision, really a 3-2-4 decision, but let's not get into that right now, with a plurality of five people, with Chief Justice dissenting as well as Scalia and Thomas and White. The court rules in Casey v. Planned Parenthood of Pennsylvania that Roe v. Wade is not overturned. It would be too dramatic that many years have passed, decisions made, stare decisis, it's called. Kennedy, along with David Souter and O'Connor, they were all appointed by Republican presidents, and they decided to uphold the Roe decision, put place a standard. A state law cannot exist if it puts an undue burden on a woman. That Kennedy ruled with the majority, really plurality, was a surprise. It's believed that Kennedy switched his vote in the case between the oral argument and the writing of decision. Scalia and Kennedy took their walk. Rehnquist and Kennedy had already joined in a dissent in another case, Webster versus Reproductive Health Services, which opposed, in a dissent, a fundamental right to abortion. So in conference, Kennedy seemed to be siding with Rehnquist. But there is something, and this doesn't get reported a lot in the story about Casey. Rehnquist apparently did not say in conference that he was going to write a decision overturning Roe v. Wade. Didn't mention it in conference, yet in his proposed opinion that ended up on Kennedy's desk, Rehnquist did just that, overturned Roe v. Wade. Kennedy received the opinion, must have thought it through, maybe it must have thought that overturning Roe was too far, and wrote a handwritten note to Harry Blackmun, the author of the Roe v. Wade decision, still on the court at this time when it's being challenged. Kennedy says, "I need to speak with you when you get a chance. I have welcome news." Nice little polite handwritten note. Indeed, it was welcome news to Blackmun. Kennedy would side with the plurality in the case. Scalia's dissent was angry. He quoted Dred Scott. He threw O'Connor and Kennedy's words and other opinions back at them. He scoffed at the notion of abortion as liberty. He made fun of the language in the opinion, and he warned that protesters would be at our steps forever now. And he said, "Behold the imperial judiciary. This is not what we're supposed to be doing." Yeah, Scalia was a little bit angry. It's not a court of machines, it's a court of men and women. And yes, it's subject to personality. It's subject to personal lobbying and cajoling by one justice to another. It's not new. Earl Warren, fresh off a stint as governor of California, really popular guy, won both the Democratic and Republican primaries at the same time in the state. Everybody wanted Earl Warren, candidate for vice president, Eisenhower's pick for the Supreme Court, gets on the court, and his personal persuasion is what convinced, more than anything, that court to be unanimous in the Brown versus Board of Education decision. Justice John Marshall, not the first justice, but the justice that established a real prestige and precedent of the Supreme Court, was well known for his persuasive abilities, convincing the court to vote unanimously and even all boarding together. That is until Jefferson got elected president and started appointing justices of his own who started issuing dissents. So it is a court of personality by his own admission. There are no cliques or cabals in the court. We avoid that, Kennedy says, by discussing things in open conference. Now, there might be a matter where I go over and say to Scalia, "Nino, we have a technical problem here, but if we really get into it, a memo goes out to all the other justices." Yet in Casey, the cabaling or clicking may have happened after the oral argument and that conference vote. And certainly a friendly, moderate bloc formed between O'Connor, Souter, and Kennedy, blocking the conservatives from being too much so. Indeed, at the same time as Casey, there was Leavers-Weissman, a school prayer decision, where this moderate bloc manifested itself as well. "The most swingingest justice," said a New Republic article. Yes, it's an odd thing, isn't it? The reality of votes on the court that can frustrate those who seek a less political model for the Supreme Court. One clerk reported Harry Blackmun as saying, "You know how to change law in the United States?" And he held up his hand. Five fingers. Five votes, he said. Five votes. That either comes out as pragmatic or really, really sad, depending on your perspective. I mean, is that really what it is? When it reaches the point where all eyes on the momentaneous differences of law and the great questions of our society come down to one Owen Roberts or one Anthony Kennedy trying to change his mind. It seems a valid criticism of the system. But I suppose it is what is, and thus, for insight into what might have happened in the secret conference vote the justices had on Obama's health care reform, whether this presidential landmark achievement to bring health care to Americans is to survive, all eyes are on Tony. If we are to be free of an awesome burden on all of us that puts us in shackles and chains, according to critics, All eyes are on Tony. So what's Tony going to say? Well, we'll give up for the moment and join the fun. If you listen to some comments, Jeffrey Tobin, for instance, the healthcare bill, critics call Obamacare, is in grave danger. Oh, come on, Jeffrey. Are we kidding ourselves here? Do oral questions in the Supreme Court of the United States have anything to do with the decision? Don't we know that the Supremes love to play devil's advocate? They hide their intentions. That's indeed been my feeling. And you sort of see that in the Casey decision. Now, Justice Kennedy is going to rule that abortion is a fundamental liberty, a fundamental right protected by the Constitution, though he personally abhorred the practice. You wouldn't know it from the oral argument. In the oral argument, he is skeptical when the Planned Parenthood attorney says that abortion is a fundamental right. He says, well, you can make that case that abortion is a fundamental right, but we've ruled free speech is, and we still see plenty of cases. Yet when Governor Casey's lawyers from Pennsylvania come defending the restrictions on abortion, argue that the statute provision for notifying husbands say the law will affect only 1% of people, and that other provisions will only affect up to 10%. He seems less sympathetic. Now, it's a very strange argument to say that the law doesn't concern us because it only affects 90% of people, Kennedy says, echoing a point that Justice Stevens makes in the oral argument. Overall, one notices the absence of tea leaves there. Aristotle once said that we can write about what was, what is, and what ought to be. This court, Kennedy said, the Supreme Court, is best when it writes about what ought to be. Fairly recent case, parents involved in this community schools for Seattle. Seattle decides that it will base its schools on where the student lives, but also where there's too many students in a particular school's area gunning for that one school. The school system will decide based on race. Lawyers for Seattle come forward. Kennedy complains that Seattle used race to ensure educational opportunity to determine school lines and resources such as magnet schools, which he says should be a last resort. But as the petitioner, a group of parents involved in the Seattle school systems come forward who want to overturn the racial quotas, he asks those lawyers, could race be used to determine where a new school would be located? When they said no, he said, a new school? They'd have to flip a coin? Kennedy, in that case, telegraphed almost exactly where he would go in the decision. With the majority against Seattle's plan, it was overruled and Kennedy joined that, but he wrote a concurrent opinion that made it clear that race could be used by school systems as a factor among many. Kennedy was clearly concerned that a school who perhaps decided on a new site location, partially based on race, might get sued in the future. I used to think, when I first got here to this court, that it was just another appeals court. Wrong. We are a teaching institution, Kennedy said. Courts will follow our lead. So he's a teacher. There's a clue. But he may not be a teacher that you would want to give an apple to. The oral argument in the Supreme Court of the United States is a give and take. It's a fast style talk of lawyer speak. Interruptions are common. Sentences are rarely finished. Paragraphs almost never. There's always the chance Scalia will make fun of you if you're a lawyer appearing before the court. Kennedy won't do it, but it doesn't mean he's meek. Because of his role in Casey, judicial observers and abortion advocates were surprised when Kennedy upheld a federal partial birth abortion ban in Gonzalez v. Carhart. In oral argument, he asked the petitioner's attorney opposing the ban a simple but deadly question. Can the state mandate a procedure if it's not the safest? Yes, the lawyer was forced to respond. Sure it can. Well, Kennedy says, the obverse of my question, can the state prohibit a procedure even if it is the safest? It must be so. Aha, trap sprung. Petitioner protests, but the point is made. Kennedy goes on to hit the respondent a little, asking how an appeal can be made if there's only 26, 24 hours. The significant action is in his question to Carhart and Carhart's lawyers. I've argued in front of judges, Kennedy said. I know they are not at ease, and we are. I try to be conscientious of that. Sometimes I'll ask a question just to help the attorney make the point they want to make. Aha, a clue to what we might be hearing. That's evident in McDonald v. Chicago. This is the Second Amendment case where the court with Kennedy joining, applied the Second Amendment to the states under the Due Process Clause. That meant Chicago lost the case, but the NRA and McDonald didn't quite get what they wanted either. They wanted protection under the Privileges and Immunities Clause of the 14th Amendment, not just the due process. What's the difference? Well, there's very little time to explain all this. I do plan a whole cast on the 14th. But basically, making something a privilege and immunity of the American people would make gun ownership as sacred as the speechwriter or the right to freely travel. Due process just means you can't do what Chicago was outright handgun banned, but fair rules would survive the test. What became the main issue in this case was not so much whether Chicago was going to lose it, but whether we would go with due process or privileges and immunities. To the McDonald lawyer, he said, "Give me some rights that we'll be denied of if we don't strike down slaughterhouse cases." And that means if we do apply all of the Bill of Rights, including the Second, to the 14th Amendment, to the states. Well, the McDonald lawyer responds, the right to a grand jury before indictment, which all states do not have. "Do you really want me to leave the bench with that?" Kennedy said. But he also destroyed the Chicago lawyer. "Tell me how we can side with your opinion and then not overturn Heller. How would we do that?" Obviously, he had just decided Heller that an individual right was in the Second, so he wasn't about to overturn his decision. His skepticism of both Chicago's lawyer and the McDonald lawyer shows in the decision and shows in the oral argument. No suspense, not much of a difference. Kennedy is not silent in oral argument. Justice Clarence Thomas, for instance, does not participate in the oral argument. Scalia does, though he's also said that it never convinces him. About 60 pages, Scalia says in a brief, and I can get a sense of where I'm going to go. Why do justices participate in the oral argument? Participate sometimes to influence other justices. Kennedy says a smart lawyer can sense the discussion the court is going to have in the back room. You want to bring up what one of your fellow justices has argued. A few more oral arguments to consider and how they matched up with Kennedy's rulings. In Bush v. Gore, Kennedy grills the Gore attorney on the question of whether the Florida court created new law and therefore the Supreme Court must step in. He is also skeptical of the difference between counting methods. But he throws this question at Ted Olson, Bush's attorney. "Are you saying that by challenging the Supreme Court, that the state can't use its courts? This is serious business. It makes every state law a federal question." Despite lobbing that one on to Olson, he rejected it when he sided with the majority in the decision ending that election crisis, overruling the Florida court. In Walmart v. Dukes, the class action sexual harassment suit against the national retail chain, he has but one comment in oral argument. He catches the lawyer for Ms. Dukes, who is suing the retail chain. "On one hand, you are saying that all this harassment is directed from headquarters. Then on the other, you're saying that Walmart gave the managers too much leeway. Which one is it?" No surprise there. With that one comment, he would end up ruling against Dukes and for Walmart. In Citizens United versus FEC, that very popular decision allowing the super PACs of today's politics, allowing companies to spend out of their corporate treasury. Once again, Ted Olson is before him. He says, "Okay, so an office holder goes to a corporation and says, will you please give me the money? They say, we can't do that. Now the corporation takes the initiative and just takes out an ad for a candidate. It seems like the same thing." That question makes him appear pro-campaign finance reform. But then to the Solicitor General, he suggests, let's take an example where one corporation is getting a benefit from the government. Shouldn't company B have a right to ask an opinion about it and expose what they're getting? This is a very pro-corporate hypothetical. He would end up ruling with the majority in knocking down restrictions on corporate speech. In Leavers-Weissman, a school graduation ceremony in Rhode Island was to feature a rabbi who would give a prayer. Deborah Weissman's father did not like this very much, and it went to the Supreme Court. In the case, Anthony Kennedy, in oral argument, is fairly active, telling the school's lawyer, "I find it difficult to believe that there is not a substantial imposition on a young graduate to say your choice is hearing the prayer or attend your graduation." No, the lawyer, who happens to be Ken Starr, says, "It is not instructional. Suppose attendance is required?" He asked Starr. Not looking very good. "Suppose the class is asked to rise." It is equally harsh when Weissman's attorney comes up. He tests for limits. "Suppose a rabbi comes to the graduation and says, we've been praying for You, young graduates, and we, the churches and synagogues, are open to you, and we hope you will take advantage of us. Is that a violation? Yes, the Weissman lawyer says. But they were not asked to stand. It's a judgment call. But if you read that oral argument, he seems more committed to the attack on Starr's position than the question thrown out to Weissman, which seems a little more academic. Okay, so what do we get from this look at fairly recent history and applying it to today's? He's a case-by-case guy with a strong individual liberty streak. He's not eccentric. He's more readable than suggested. While Scalia might throw in the big statement or sarcastic line, Kennedy will lob the big constitutional grenade. He asks questions of lawyers. Other times he gives his position or expresses a concern. By his own admission, he sometimes helps a lawyer make an argument. And when that's done, you can kind of subtract that. When he directly states a position versus a question, and you can't answer it as a lawyer, appearing before him, you're in trouble. It's not a precise analysis, but it's my take on it. And given that, I can talk a bit about the oral arguments for healthcare recently and where Kennedy contributed quite a bit. I focus only on day two, where the individual mandate, the most central question of constitutionality in the healthcare, was discussed. Right off the bat, Kennedy lobbing a big one at Solicitor General Varelli, who is defending the president's healthcare plan. He asks, can you create commerce in order to regulate it? In other words, he means, are you forcing people to buy insurance, that's the individual mandate in the president's healthcare reform bill, and then claiming it is commerce you can regulate after you force people to buy it? When Varelli counters that the purchasing of healthcare has substantial effects on interstate commerce, Kennedy's opening salvo now gets Scalia a chance to move in. Any self-purchasing? Then Scalia mentions Broccoli, Roberts, the cell phone use, since it could be used in emergency, why can't the government mandate it, and Alito's famous reference to burial insurance, because people don't have it, might force all of us to incur costs when we have to pay to bury them. Kennedy continues, your question is, what is the limit to the Commerce Clause? You seem to have a very high burden of justification. But when he gets to the lawyer for the state suing the federal government, Paul Clement, he switches a little. Doesn't an insurance company use people who are sitting in their living rooms doing nothing in order to calculate risk? Aren't they involved in the market then? The actuaries are counting them in the market. Clement says, no, they're out of the market. They're not participating in the insurance market by not buying it. But they create a risk that the market has to account for, Kennedy asks. The young person who is uninsured is uniquely very close to affecting the rates of insurance and the cost in a way that is not true in other industries. The young person is my concern. Not being a legal scholar, I just looked at a few of his oral arguments and how he came down to the decisions, but a couple of things are obvious. Sure, he lobbed that big constitutional grenade at Varelli. Maybe it was just getting at what Scalia has been saying in the back room. He wanted to see if he could get an answer from Varelli. The opinion of most experts is that the Solicitor General didn't answer it well. But he did express a concern at the end. And the answer to the concern from the state's lawyers is that, well, if you're concerned about the young people, we're denying them, though in the health care bill, the one thing that they can get from the market, which is a very high deductible plan. That's not available to them. So there can't be an economic solution. Because of the nature of oral argument, they moved on. Kennedy didn't continue to press on that point, so we can't divine too much there. I come out of reading the day two transcript with a red flag that Justice Kennedy expressed a clear concern and may come down that way. He's not a textual justice. He's not a yes or no justice. I would not be surprised, given that he sees his role as a teacher, that he's either asked to write the decision or, since that's up to Chief Justice Roberts who writes the decision, he can't control that, or he may write a concurrent with, if they're going to knock down the individual mandate, don't be surprised if Kennedy gives some instructions on what kind of bill he could get along with. Tea leaves, tea leaves. Why do we even have to think of one guy and what he might think? Why does that even be important in America? The perfect machine of government runs more like an old Ford Torino than a fine-tuned Camry, right? It's a machine desired to have these parts. The president is the enforcer. Congress is the lawmaker. The courts just interpret. The courts are not involved in the politics that Congress and the president are involved in. But it works in a clunky way. The Supreme Court is not totally independent. It's independent And then every once in a while, the president, that awful, non-independent politician guy, gets to shake it up and disrupt it by appointing someone. He can only disrupt it, though, within the constraints of who controls the Senate. It was up to the president alone. Why, Reagan would have appointed Robert Bork. He'd be there, he'd be old, but he'd be there, and we wouldn't even be having this discussion. The individual mandate would not even be an issue. Thus, you don't get the independence of the court from a magic source. You get it in the form of a person, of an Owen or a Tony, who, of course, is going to annoy both sides of a question. A faster way of saying this, the presence of someone like Kennedy on the court is not a quirk. I want to thank you for listening. The website is www.myhistorycanbeatupyourpolitics.com. At that site, we do sell our archive. Right now, it's $14.99. I'm considering a price increase. I'm just going to say that. I'm not saying it to try to sell. I'm just, you know, something I'm considering. We have a Facebook site there where you can comment. And if you do like the program, please tell somebody about it. Thanks for listening.